today on Against the Grain. Many of us have heard about the criminalization of African Americans in the Jim Crow South. But the often unacknowledged flip side of that coin is, according to Tammy Ingram, the decriminalization of whites. I'm CS. The College of Charleston professor joins me to discuss an egregious example of state-sanctioned white organized crime coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The brutal treatment of African Americans in the Jim Crow South by local citizens and government officials is well documented. What rarely gets attention is how white residents and especially local officials tolerated, enabled, and even actively collaborated with white criminal enterprises. In other words, existing alongside black folks who suffered disproportionate arrest and incarceration rates were white people who violated the law with impunity, who had little or nothing to fear from local law enforcement or elected officials. According to Tammy Ingram, white criminal syndicates in Phoenix City, Alabama, did what they wanted to do while local officials looked the other way or actively supported their activities. Tammy is working on a book about white criminal enterprises and government corruption in the Jim Crow South, and some of her research is encapsulated in an article she contributed to the new volume, Crime and Punishment in the Jim Crow South, edited by Amy Wood and Natalie Ring. When Tammy Ingram joined me recently via Skype, I asked what motivated her to focus on white mobsters and their allies in government in Phoenix City, Alabama.
Well, initially it was just because it was an interesting story that I had never heard of. It was also interesting to me because I actually grew up not far from the city I'm writing about, Phoenix City, Alabama. And so when I first sort of got an inkling of what had gone on there in the first half of the 20th century, I was fascinated by it because I had never heard anything about it before. The other thing that got me interested was I'm a big fan of film noir, and I stumbled across a film called The Phoenix City Story, and it seemed so dramatic and so unbelievable that I didn't really think it was true at first. And when I learned that it was, I was convinced that the film probably had exaggerated a lot of things. And it does dramatize some things. But as I dug into it, I realized that most of what's in the film it's largely true. And I was interested in using the film in a seminar that I teach about film in Southern history. So I just initially did some research just so I could teach the film to my students. But I became more and more interested in it and decided that it was a good topic for a second book. There have been a couple of books about it, but most of them focus on a particular dramatic event that happened, the murder in 1954. And none of them had really delved into the backstory about how an organized crime syndicate came to be in Jim Crow, Alabama.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that 1954 murder. But I want to first dial you back to the early 19th century. So this town, this city called Phoenix City, Alabama, as you said, it was then known as Girard. What was it known for in the early 1800s?
Well, in the early 1800s, just on the cusp of Alabama becoming a state, this was pretty unorganized territory. It was Creek territory. Georgia was already a state. And so it was part of what then was known as the Old Southwest, which it had a reputation that we would probably, you know, now associate with the later 19th century, in the Wild West, where it was fairly lawless. And it had a reputation for being a kind of safe haven for fugitives and outlaws who would run over into this unorganized territory from the state of Georgia. And I should point out for listeners who might not know the geography that Phoenix City sits, I'm going to call it Phoenix City by its current name, but it sits on the western bank of the Chattahoochee River, which is the border between Alabama and Georgia. And so it's a pretty quick distance. So if someone was running from the law in Georgia, running from a federal marshal, they didn't have to go very far to be in safe territory. And so it had a reputation for being a pretty rough place.
What kinds of what some people might call unsavory establishments existed in Phoenix City then, Gerard?
Well, in the early 19th century, there weren't a lot of official businesses necessarily. It was, but there was a lot of violence, a lot of drunken brawls and murders and all kinds of things that served as kind of testaments to the lawlessness that characterized frontier life, whether there or, elsewhere in the West later in the 19th century. But as the century wore on, and by the turn of the 20th century, the area around Phoenix City, and there was one particular little community that was known as Girard, that was located at the base of one of the two bridges that linked Georgia and Alabama across the Chattahoochee River. So people could cross over very conveniently, just walk across the bridge, and find any number of saloons, gambling houses, brothels, pretty much anything illegal that they wanted to buy.
What effect did the economy, the U.S. economy in the 1920s, and the local economy, and the, I guess you focus a lot on the, in terms of the economic environment in which white organized crime emerged in a big way, you focus on the pre-Great Depression decade. What effect did that have on the emergence of white organized crime?
It had a tremendous influence on what ended up happening in Phoenix City. We can actually go all the way back to the mid-19th century to start, because most of the wealth in that part of the Deep South in the second half of the 19th century was derived, especially after the Civil War, was derived from cotton manufacturing industry. So there was a Supreme Court decision in the mid-19th century that, and I'm going to, this is a gross oversimplification, but there was basically a dispute between two mill owners on either side of the Chattahoochee River, one in Alabama, one in Georgia. And the Supreme Court essentially decided that the Chattahoochee River belonged to Georgia. And so that killed the fledgling cotton mill industry in and around Phoenix City. And so while communities on the other side of the river in Georgia became very wealthy, going into the early 20th century, Phoenix City really struggled, literally on the margins of the industrialized South. And so they never really recovered financially from that. So going into the early 20th century, by the eve of the Great Depression, the area around Phoenix City, and the county is Russell County, was really in financial dire straits. And in the early 1930s, was going into federal receivership because the county was bankrupt. And so they were really looking for a way to make money. And there were all of these illegal establishments that had continued to exist there, mostly saloons and gambling houses. There were other things too, but that was the bulk of it. And so the city saw an opportunity to make some money. And so they essentially went into business with those illegal establishments in order to keep the city afloat.
And how did they go into business?
Well, they decided to start issuing business licenses to those businesses, even though they were violating state laws against alcohol and sales and gambling. They also realized that if they sort of tolerated these businesses, they could set up a system of fines and fees. So in addition to the revenue that they derived from the business licenses, they would occasionally raid these businesses, except the owners usually knew in advance that they were coming. And they would shut them down just to sort of placate the public, shut them down, wag their fingers at them and, fine them. And then they would, ultimately be allowed to reopen. But the city depended on that revenue from the licenses, but also from the fines and court fees. But there was never really any serious worry that they were going to be shut down. So it was all a part of a kind of agreement between the business owners and city officials. And at that time, in the early 1930s, when all of this started, the city commission was just basically three men who could do whatever they wanted. So in essence, they kind of decided to do this, and local people didn't put up much of a fight.
Another theme that comes out in this chapter is the balance of power between the state of Alabama and its cities and counties. And so one might think, well, if white criminal syndicates in Phoenix City didn't necessarily fear the local authorities because they were kind of in bed with the local government or vice versa, maybe they would have to worry about the state coming down on them. And yet, in 1901, there was a new state constitution in Alabama, and there was a constitutional convention. What did that do to the balance of power between Alabama on the one hand and its localities on the other?
So one thing that is sort of constant throughout this story is that state officials in Alabama who were in a position to, could have been in a position to put a stop to all of this, chose not to. The reasons for that sort of shifted over time, but ultimately it was because of this sort of political culture that was, a very kind of laissez-faire approach to governance, where the state did not want, the federal government interfering in its affairs, and state officials were reluctant to intervene in local affairs. But the Constitution, Alabama's Constitution in 1901, helped to sort of cement this this relationship between local and state officials. One of the most important things the 1901 Constitution did, it disfranchised black voters, which is something a lot of other state constitutions in the 1890s and early 1900s were doing. However, delegates to the state constitution in 1901 also crafted a kind of one historian has called it a passive referee state, that even while it did not provide for home rule, it preserved local control in many ways over day-to-day governance. So, for instance, one provision of the Constitution cut the state legislative session in half. Another one, and this one was very important, and it's probably the one that people, most people are most familiar with if they know anything about, say, the George Wallace regime in Alabama. Another provision curtailed the power of the executive branch by prohibiting officials like governors, attorney generals, the Secretary of State from serving consecutive terms in office. And so you could only serve one term at a time. And this created a pretty fractious and disordered state government in which there wasn't a lot of consistency, a lot of continuity. And it contributed to a political scientist actually has called it a kind of atmosphere of frontier independence, in which local citizens and also local officials didn't really worry about defying state leaders because, the governor or the attorney general was not going to be in power long enough to really do anything to stop them.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Tammy Ingram is my guest. She teaches history at the College of Charleston. And her article, her chapter in the new volume, Crime and Punishment in the Jim Crow South, uses white criminal syndicates in Phoenix City, Alabama, to explore how state-sanctioned crime, white organized crime, shaped politics and justice in Jim Crow, Alabama. Let's talk about Hoyt Shepard. So Hoyt Shepard was kind of the kingpin of the mob in Phoenix City. What was he about, and what kind of impunity did he operate under?
Yeah, so there were quite a number of people who were involved in the rackets in Phoenix City, but Hoyt Shepard was without a doubt the most powerful one and the most successful one. Like most other racketeers, he was white, he was a native Southerner, but he really got his start in the early 1930s, right around the time that Phoenix City sort of, I'll put it in sort of air quotes, legalized gambling. It was against the state law, but when the city decided to cooperate with the rackets, that's around the time he moved to Phoenix City. So he really got his start when he partnered with another person named Jimmy Matthews to form what they themselves referred to as a syndicate. It was called the S&M. For Shepard and Matthews, S&M Amusement Company. And they started a lottery, which locally everyone called the Bug. And by the 1940s, it was not the only lottery in Phoenix City, but it was by far the largest. They also started a big slot machine business and had a couple of the nicer casinos in Phoenix City. He wielded tremendous control over local government And I can give you a couple of examples of his power. One happened early on in his career in Phoenix City in the late 1930s, when the building that he owned, that he ran his lottery out of, collapsed. He had ignored the city's warnings and the building inspectors who told him that the building was not sound and that it needed to have some repairs. He didn't do anything about it. And one day, just before the lottery numbers were being announced, there were, you know, a couple hundred people crowded into the second floor of this building, and the whole building collapsed.
Yeah, and you're right that 24 people were killed and 83 others were seriously injured. So one would expect the city would come down hard on Shepard.
Right? They didn't, for two reasons. One, most of the victims were African Americans. And so while, you know, this was a dramatic story and everyone thought it was a tragedy, the victims were Black. And so it was less concern. And the other reason is just that, you know, Shepard was an extremely powerful person in town, and the lottery brought in a lot of money for the town, employed a lot of people, and lined the city government's coffers. And so nothing happened at all. The local police dodged questions when reporters would ask them about, you know, possible charges against the building's owners. Survivors and relatives of people who died were reluctant to testify because they were concerned about the pushback. And so the city commission, which had kind of launched a half-hearted inquiry into the disaster, ended up dropping it.
And you have another example as far as Hoyt Shepard and how he was able to do what he wanted in Phoenix City?
Yes, this one is maybe less dramatic, but no less serious. In 1946, Shepard and his associates sort of got into a turf war with a man named Fayette Leburn, who was from the other side of the river in Columbus, a businessman who was also interested in gambling and was into the slot machine business. And he and Shepard get into kind of a turf war. And in the fall, I think it was in September of 1946, they invited Leburn over to Phoenix City to an election party for one of the syndicate's buddies who had just gotten elected either as mayor or city commissioner. I can't remember which. And he went into a back room with them to talk business and never left the room. Someone shot him. It was either Hoyt Shepard or his brother, both of whom were arrested and charged with murder. The brother claimed that he shot Leburn in self-defense, but prosecutors were not sure which one actually did it, so they put them both on trial. But it was essentially a sham trial. The circuit solicitor in those days, there's not a district attorney or a solicitor just assigned to that one county. In more sparsely populated areas, they would cover two or three or four different counties. So this was a guy who wasn't from Phoenix City. He had no ties to the mob. He wasn't under their control. So he really made a sincere effort to bring the Shepard brothers to justice. And he failed because he discovered that the police had, he thought intentionally, failed to collect evidence in the case. They had handled the murder weapon, you know, and destroying fingerprint evidence, obviously. A parade of defense witnesses came on the stand and backed up the Shepard's version of events, even though allegedly no one else was actually in the room when it happened. And the jury ended up acquitting both of them in separate trials. Now, the solicitor was outraged by this and immediately went to the press. And when I say that, I mean not to the local Phoenix City newspapers, but across the river in Columbus, where the newspaper editors were very, very critical of Phoenix City and were sort of heroic always in their condemnation of what went on there and their, you know, sincere interest in exposing the corruption that was happening across the river. So the solicitor went to the Columbus newspapers and said, and sort of outlined his case and said that he believed the jury had been tampered with. And there were wiretaps that suggested that probably, you know, had happened. In response, the newspaper reporters went into the Russell County court records and found evidence of all kinds of corruption in the court system, including routine failures to prosecute the racketeers. They found that in an 18-month period in the mid-1940s, 56 different people were arrested for violating state gambling laws, and not one of them went to trial. They were all allowed to forfeit bonds. The only thing that really happened is that the Shepherd brothers' reputations took a hit, because this was a rare instance when they actually had to face, you know, go to trial and face at least the possibility, however slim it was, that they might be prosecuted for something. So they immediately launched a kind of public relations effort to counter the negative publicity. And just a few weeks after the trial, for instance, they donated close to $100,000 to construct a new hospital for Russell County citizens, which they promptly named for the mayor who had defended them and allowed all of this to continue for years.
So these white mobsters in Phoenix City, they keep getting off scot-free. They're either not prosecuted or they're acquitted. How does this compare with how African Americans were treated by, for example, law enforcement in the same city in Alabama?
Well, not surprisingly, the treatment of African Americans couldn't have been any more different. Just to give you a couple of statistics to get a good sense of how sort of imbalanced the prosecutions were. In the year after the city went into business with the mob in 1933, a year later, the county didn't record a single arrest of a white person.
Not one white person in Phoenix City was arrested that entire year?
That entire year. Now, in subsequent years, that's not the case. White people were arrested, but in most of that time, African Americans were arrested at a disproportionate rate. Up to about 70% of the arrests were African Americans in Russell County. And this actually exceeds even the state average. And more importantly than just who is arrested is really who, you know, what kind of punishments are meted out. There's also evidence of quite a bit of violence against African Americans who were arrested in Phoenix City. There are a number of cases. All of this came out in the mid-1950s when the mob starts to get shut down. There were a number of charges that local law enforcement had viciously beaten African-American inmates. The local sheriff allegedly, you know, forced inmates to work on his farm for him. He also coerced an African-American woman. It's not clear if she was an inmate or not, but she worked as his family's cook and maid, and slept at the jail every night. I should say that the gambling establishments and the brothels in Phoenix City were racially segregated, like every other business in town. There were African-American gambling houses and dance halls and saloons, most of which were owned by white racketeers, but run by African-American managers. And while whites could go into those establishments if they wanted to, and sometimes they did, African-Americans were certainly never allowed into any of the white establishments. So the city segregated, even in the racketeering business, it's very segregated. But I actually, not that long ago, finally found the old ledger books kept by the sheriff's department and the city police. They shared a jail. And I haven't broken the data down yet to sort of see the how the severity of the crimes that African Americans were accused of compared to those that whites were accused of. But it's very, very clear in those records that African Americans constitute the overwhelming majority of people who were arrested, and that the whites who were arrested rarely, rarely included any of the racketeers themselves.
Tammy Ingram joins us on Against the Grain. She is Associate Professor of History at the College of Charleston. We'll take a short break and speak more with Tammy about her very interesting work into criminal enterprise in the South, in the Jim Crow South, in conjunction with government corruption. Please stay with us. Thank you. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Tammy Ingram teaches history at the College of Charleston. Her new book project is entitled The Wickedest City in America, The Rise and Fall of Organized Crime in the Jim Crow South. And it examines criminal syndicates, white criminal syndicates, government corruption, and challenges to the sexual and racial order in the Jim Crow South. And some of the insights that will be in that book were part of an article, a chapter that Tammy contributed to the new volume, Crime and Punishment in the Jim Crow South. It's edited by Amy Wood and Natalie Ring. Tammy is also author of Dixie Highway, Road Building and the Making of the Modern South, 1900 to 1930. So you were talking about something that I think tends to come out a fair amount in the history of what was happening in the South during Jim Crow, and that is the criminalization of African Americans, the brutal treatment of African Americans at the hands of local law enforcement authorities. But your focus, and I found it very unique and interesting, and that's why I invited you on today, is on the decriminalization of whites with a focus on white criminal syndicates. How important is this decriminalization of white people, white criminals under Jim Crow as compared, say, with the way African Americans were treated by authorities?
Well, I think it's the other side of the coin. I think that we have to look at the decriminalization of whites, of really other, you know, people with any sort of wealth and social status who in the Jim Crow South were, by and large, whites, especially white men. We have to look at the decriminalization of those people as a conscious and proactive process, not just as a sort of unintended consequence of criminalizing people of color. And I think it's important because in many ways it sort of underscores how pernicious Jim Crow regimes really were, that they are not only criminalizing African Americans, but they are actually going out of their way to protect and shield whites, especially powerful whites. And I think that just sort of drives home how much effort it took to keep these regimes in power. There's been a lot of great scholarship about how the day-to-day processes of segregation required a lot of effort on behalf of citizens and local and state officials just to maintain that system. I think this is another part of that. It took a lot of effort to maintain this system and a lot of coordinated effort on the part of local and state officials to protect white people who were accused of crimes. Now, I'm not suggesting that what was happening in Phoenix City is in any way typical, but I do think that it's a particularly egregious example of white criminality that just underscores how willing local and state officials were to protect them.
Were police officers and city officials in Phoenix City, were they actually on the payroll of this white criminal syndicate? I mean, did the connection go that deep?
Yeah, some of them literally were on the payrolls. Others were just, you know, if they wanted to keep their jobs, they, you know, had to go along with what was going on. But just a couple of examples, the deputy sheriff and the assistant chief of police were both involved in the sex trade in Phoenix City. They were actually partners in brothels in Phoenix City and made a lot of money from that. And there's also some evidence that both of them, but particularly the assistant chief of police, had a tendency to arrest women who may or may not have been involved in the sex trade. Maybe they were working as prostitutes, maybe they weren't. And he would, either in exchange for them having sex with him or agreeing to go to work for him or for another, you know, someone else who was involved in the sex trade in Phoenix City, would sort of barter their bail based on their willingness to. So it's, you know, a form of debt peonage, that they use their powers of arrest to sort of coerce women into the sex trade.
You spoke earlier about Hoyt Shepard being tried for a murder of a rival gambler. This is in September 1946, and you said that the guy who prosecuted Shepard was A.S. Borders, who was a circuit solicitor. So he wasn't specific, his jurisdiction wasn't specific to Phoenix City, Alabama. What did the mob was obviously upset with Borders for prosecuting Shepard, this kingpin in Phoenix City. What happened? What did they do? You know, and how is that a sign of the mob's ability to effect change in the political landscape of Alabama and locally?
Yes, this is one of the most interesting stories about the mob's power and influence in both local and state government. They realized that they had dodged a bullet after the Shepard brothers were acquitted. For all of their efforts to, you know, tamper with the jury and make sure that they were acquitted, you know, it could have gone another way. So they realized that controlling the solicitor was a very important thing for them to do if they wanted to continue to operate with immunity. And so one of the attorneys, when the Shepard brothers were brought to trial, they basically hired every attorney in town, one of whom was a man named Albert Patterson, who had no real experience as a criminal trial attorney. He was a family lawyer. You know, he handled divorce cases and probate cases and pretty mundane things. But he happened to be running for the state legislature at that time. And so in return for his willingness to serve as one of the defense attorneys, Hoyt Shepard used his power and his money to support Patterson's campaign. And just a few weeks after the Shepard brothers were acquitted, or a few weeks after Hoyt, who was the first one to be tried, was acquitted, Albert Patterson was elected to the state legislature. And with lots of encouragement, obviously, from Hoyt Shepard and other racketeers, one of the first things Patterson did was introduce a bill in the state legislature to get Russell County, where Phoenix City is located, designated as a single county circuit. And this is very significant because usually single county circuits tended to be urban areas, places like Birmingham or Montgomery, where there's a larger population, and it makes more sense for a single county to have its own solicitor because presumably in a larger county, the caseload will be bigger. So they need a dedicated person to handle those cases. It's very unusual for that to happen in a smaller county like Russell County. But the bill passed. And the next thing that Patterson did to help them out was to take their recommendation that a very particular person, a young lawyer named Arch Farrell from Phoenix City, that he be appointed circuit solicitor.
You mean he'd take over for Borders, who would be out?
Right. Borders is out at this point. Borders, I don't really know what became of him after this. He most likely continued to be solicitor in these other counties, but now that Russell County was a single county circuit, it needed its own solicitor. And so Patterson helped to engineer the appointment of Arch Farrell. And Farrell was very closely aligned with the rackets and ended up being a very important ally for them. So, for instance, obviously as solicitor, he had tremendous total control over who was indicted. It was not uncommon for grand juries under Farrell's reign to not return any indictments at all. So he used his position to shield racketeers from any kind of serious prosecution from that point forward.
So Albert Patterson, he helps the racketeers. He arranges and facilitates the appointment of this new solicitor who is an ally of the mob. And yet, and this is another interesting part of your story, Patterson does not remain an ally of the mob. He turns into an opponent of it. How did that happen?
Yeah, and it happened in a very short period of time. Now, Albert Patterson had been an attorney. He's from Alabama originally. He had lived in Phoenix City since the early 1930s. He moved there, in fact, right around the time the city sort of went into business with the mob. But he never considered himself, when he was Hoyt Shepard's attorney in the murder trial in 1946, and even when he was elected to the state legislature and helped to get Russell County designated as a single county circuit, he never thought of himself as an ally for the mob. He was always very careful to to make a distinction there. And he said that, you know, his duty as an attorney was to provide a good defense for anyone. The thing he said about the Shepherd case in particular was that, you know, that Shepherd had hired his services but not bought his soul.
Mm.
Nevertheless, Patterson certainly was indispensable to the mob's game plan in the late 1940s. He had a break with them just about 3 years after the Shepherd trial. He got into a spat with Governor James Folsom, who was sort of an ally of the mob. Folsom was not involved directly with the racketeers in Phoenix City, but he was willing to look the other way and not terribly concerned with what was going on in Phoenix City. So Patterson got into a spat with Folsom over something that had nothing to do with racketeering. It was just a patronage appointment that Patterson disagreed with him over. And that was part of the break. He also, when it became clear that he wasn't really going to be a proactive ally of the racketeers, they started to turn on him as well. He stopped supporting Governor Folsom's agenda in the state legislature. This drove an even bigger wedge between him and the racketeers, who still supported Folsom. He ran for lieutenant governor, Patterson did, in 1950. He was always very politically ambitious. And that campaign really foundered when the racketeers aligned against him, when they realized that he was just trying to undermine Folsom.
And then there was a local corruption fighting group in Phoenix City called the Russell Betterman Association that he was involved with. He and this association, this organization, decided that Patterson would run for state attorney general, and the attorney general of the state had the power to investigate and target and indict racketeers, you know, without approval from local authorities, which, of course, the local authorities would not approve of such things. What resistance from organized crime did Patterson's campaign for, again, attorney general encounter?
Oh, tremendous resistance. By the early 1950s, just before he ran for attorney general, Patterson once he broke with Folsom and he broke with the racketeers, they got him kicked off the local draft board, even though he was a decorated veteran of the First World War. That was a huge insult to him and really made him determined to shut down the racketeers. In the early 50s, before Patterson ran for attorney general, there was already a clear indication that they felt threatened by Patterson and threatened by the Russell Betterman Association, this sort of local crime-fighting association. Initially, they didn't take it very seriously. They had been, in the past, there had been efforts to shut down the mob, and nothing ever came of it because they were powerful and their ties to local government were so powerful. But when Patterson really started to agitate against them, they got scared. So they did things like they set fire at one point to Patterson's law office, probably in an effort to destroy records that he was keeping that outlined some of the racketeers' violations of state laws. They were most likely the people who were behind the firebombing of a house, the home of one of Patterson's close associates in the Russell Betterman Association. His family was home at the time. Thankfully, no one was killed, but the house was destroyed. So they responded pretty violently to this. And in early 1954, when Patterson decided to run for attorney general, they really knew that they were in trouble, because up to that point, the state attorney general is really the only person who had the authority as the state's chief law enforcement official, had the authority to intervene directly in local affairs. And so they aligned themselves against Patterson and donated tens of thousands of dollars to the campaign of his opponent, a man named Red Porter, who wasn't directly aligned with the mob, but he was happy to take their money. And they did everything they could to try to stop Patterson from being elected.
That's the voice of Tammy Ingram, associate professor of history at the College of Charleston, author of Dixie Highway, Road Building and the Making of the Modern South, 1900 to 1930. And we are talking about her new book project, which examines criminal enterprise, specifically white criminal syndicates, government corruption, and challenges to the status quo in the Jim Crow South. You can find an article that she's written about white organized crime, specifically in Phoenix City, Alabama, in a new volume. It's called Crime and Punishment in the Jim Crow South, and it's published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Albert Patterson did win the Democratic Party nomination for Alabama Attorney General. And then what happened?
Well, they almost prevented him from being elected. When it was clear that he was going to eke out a very narrow victory, they actually had one of their associates change the voter rolls in Jefferson County, where Birmingham is, to make it appear that his opponent had won. The whole thing was exposed, and Patterson was declared the winner in the first week of June in 1954. He knew about the voter fraud. He knew that the mob had and their political associates had tried to change these voter rolls. And so he had threatened to testify before a grand jury in Jefferson County and go after them and start to put them away for the voter irregularities. 8 days later, Patterson was working late in his law office in downtown Phoenix City one night. He left around 9 o'clock, right as the sun was setting, and walked to his car, which was parked in an alleyway just a few feet away from the door to his office. And someone confronted him at the car and fired 3 or 4 shots at him, 3 of which hit him. And he stumbled back to his law office and collapsed and died on the sidewalk in front of his office.
Yeah, and Albert Fuller, who was the chief deputy sheriff of Russell County, which encompasses Phoenix City, he was convicted for the murder of Albert Patterson. He was sentenced to life in prison. What happened to crime and corruption as usual in Phoenix City?
Well, although Patterson's whole campaign for attorney general had been about cleaning up Phoenix City, it's this law and order campaign in which he promises to clean up the city and clean up the state. He always likened the mob in Phoenix City to an octopus that he said was, you know, extending its reach into all corners of the state. His murder actually made this crime cleanup happen a lot faster than Patterson himself probably ever could have as attorney general. Albert Patterson, as you said, the deputy sheriff, is one of 3 people suspected of being involved in his murder. The other 2 people were the county solicitor, Arch Farrell, whom Patterson had helped to get appointed to that position, and the outgoing attorney general, Silas Garrett. Both Farrell and Fuller were actually tried for the murder, but Farrell was acquitted. There's no physical evidence against him. There were 2 eyewitnesses who placed him at the scene, but there was no other evidence that he had been directly involved. But there was a palm print on Patterson's car that sealed Albert Fuller's fate. Fuller was convicted and sent to prison, but he only served 10 years. He was paroled. In the months after Patterson's murder, the state, for the first time, did get involved in Phoenix City and finally do something to try to clean up organized crime there, and also to try to address the local government corruption. I think that was the thing, more than organized crime itself, more than the saloons, the gambling houses, the brothels, it was the local government corruption that really upset people at the local level and the state level. And so they launched what became local still to this day, just called the cleanup. And they indicted 140-some-odd people on over 700 charges, most of whom did not serve any serious time, as had happened for years in Phoenix City. Most people were allowed to pay fines or, you know, got off pretty easy. Hoyt Shepard and his associates, the kingpin and those powerful racketeers in town, served just a few months in Kilby Prison. One of Shepard's children, whom I've interviewed for the book, told me that he was actually allowed to come home on the weekends to be with his family. So, you know, pretty sort of light treatment considering, you know, everything that he'd been charged with. The person who, you know, faced the most serious consequences, obviously, was Albert Fuller, who was convicted of Patterson's murder. But he was paroled after 10 years on the condition that he not return to Phoenix City.
Tammy Ingram joins us. She's associate professor of history at the College of Charleston. And Tammy, you know, some people have joined us maybe midway through the program. So I want to make sure we end by you telling us, and, you know, you began to talk about this earlier. What's important about this case study? I mean, it's very dramatic. It's violent at times. You are documenting a kind of active collaboration between public officials and white organized criminal syndicates and criminals and racketeers and mobsters in this city, Phoenix City, Alabama, in the era of the Jim Crow South. Why do you think it's so important for these details and this pattern of decriminalization of whites to come out? What does it add to the history of the Jim Crow South?
Good question. So this story, I realize on the surface, it seems absurd, right? Because we don't associate organized crime with the Deep South. And I think viewing it as this kind of oddity is part of the reason that we've overlooked this story, right? It's kind of a relic of the Southern Gothic tradition. It's very easy to dismiss. But I think it's actually not that odd. Maybe the particular circumstances in Phoenix City are unusual. But the crime and corruption that existed in Phoenix City is just one of many examples of the kinds of corruption in local and state government, a kind of injustice, especially in the court system, the kind of graft and abuses of power that were rife in these very insular Jim Crow regimes, where the federal government is having difficulty intervening and stopping these Jim Crow regimes from interfering with the constitutional rights of African-American citizens, and where the state, as we see very clearly in the case of Phoenix City, is having a difficult time putting a check on the power of local officials. I think there are, you know, plenty of examples where this kind of activity still flourishes when there are no checks and balances, where people in positions of power to actually intervene and do something don't do it. In particular, I think what's important about paying attention to the decriminalization of powerful people, especially white people in the Jim Crow South, and seeing this, as I said earlier, as a conscious and proactive process and not just sort of this, you know, unintended kind of byproduct of the criminalization of people of color. It does force us to think more carefully about the extent of white privilege and its deep historical roots. I think, it highlights how pernicious these regimes really were and how much effort it took to keep them in place and to protect the white people who protected those regimes and supported those regimes and kept them in power. And I think it also forces us to think more carefully about and maybe to assess more honestly the role that government, especially local government, plays in shaping our lives. You know, the opportunities afforded to different groups of people, the limits placed on different groups of people. These, you know, officials are not just there to kind of handle the mundane civic functions. They actually wield enormous power over individual access to equal protection under the law. And finally, I think it helps to remind us how things like race, but also wealth and social status, really continue to this day to function as powerful shields against arrest and prosecution.
So you have this Albert Patterson murdered while attempting to rein in and take on the racketeers in Phoenix City. What did Patterson's son, John M. Patterson, go on to do?
So anyone who knows anything about Southern political history should recognize John Patterson's name. At the time his father was murdered, John Patterson was just his law partner, his sort of reluctant law partner. He had come back from the Army. He'd been in the JAG program with the Army and been at the Nuremberg trials. And his dad had him come back and work in the family law practice. When his father was assassinated, John Patterson ended up running for his seat as attorney general and winning. He used that as a launch pad to become the governor of Alabama, the youngest governor in Alabama history. He became governor by defeating George Wallace in 1958. He's the person who George Wallace famously said out-N-worded him, so basically out-race-baited him in order to win. Interestingly, though Patterson had, as attorney general, had actually presided over the trials of the people who were accused of murdering his father and sort of indirectly presided over the cleanup of his hometown of Phoenix City. But when he was running for governor, he kind of had an interesting twist on his father's law and order message. And instead of talking about mostly about organized crime, as his father had 4 years earlier when he was running for attorney general, John Patterson explicitly linked that law and order message to the dangers of the burgeoning civil rights movement. And he warned in the late 1950s that crime and corruption were, you know, invading the state again, only this time it's in a new form. And he would give speeches where he would sort of link the kind of legacy of organized crime and criminal, you know, government corruption in Phoenix City, oddly enough, to organizations like the NAACP. And he would say, you know, these gangsters and the NAACP are sending in all of this money to try to defeat me in the governor's race. And it worked, and he ended up winning. And as attorney general, and then as governor, he oversaw the state's battle to try to get the NAACP declared an illegal organization in Alabama. And of course, in the early 1960s, he became infamous for refusing to protect the Freedom Riders when they came through Alabama. And when the Kennedy administration, when the Kennedy brothers called him and asked him to protect the Freedom Riders and to use his authority as governor to make sure they were safe, he refused to take their phone calls.
Tammy Ingram, history professor at the College of Charleston. Her book project, the book project she's working on, has the title The Wickedest City in America, The Rise and Fall of Organized Crime in the Jim Crow South. And her article about state-sanctioned white crime in Phoenix City, Alabama, is part of a new volume. It's called Crime and Punishment in the Jim Crow South, again, edited by Amy Wood and Natalie Ring. Tammy, thanks so much for your work, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.